There, if I got my tie on straight.
Yeah.
Right. I'm now wearing the Lambda tie. Somewhere there's a picture of it. The Lambda tie. My wife made this for me. So this is a special lecture. It's a special lecture because I wear the Lambda tie. It's the last lecture you'll have before the class exam. I will be away next week. Phil Scott, one of the TAs, will administer the class exam. He will also give you a so the class exam is next Monday at 2 o'clock. And then you will have a lecture as normal next Tuesday at 11 o'clock, which Phil will deliver, which Phil Scott will deliver. So show up for class as normal both times. Be prepared for the class exam. Are there any questions? Yes?
Is it on paper or is it on the computer?
Is the class exam on paper or on the computer? It's on paper. It will be here. It will be 35 minutes long. It's 35 minutes long because a few people need extra time, and we need to fit that within the hour slot for the class. It's not reasonable. We couldn't find the facilities to do it online, which we'd like to do, but the final exam will be online. Yes? Oh, what a good question. Could Can QuickCheck generate random functions for testing things? Yes. If QuickCheck knows how to generate type A, values of type A and type B, it can also generate functions from type A to B. So QuickCheck can generate random integers and therefore can generate random integer to integer functions. Excellent question. Okay, shall we get started? Right. Now, yesterday we talked about three of my favorite functions, map, filter, and fold. And more importantly, the notion that both functions can be arguments to other functions, because that happens with map, filter, and fold. And also that functions can be the result of functions. And we realize that we've been doing this all the time without being aware of it, because in fact the way Haskell treats a function of two arguments is as a function of one argument, which returns itself a function of the second argument, which is called currying, named after Haskell Curry. So now you begin to understand where the name Haskell comes from. Oh, excuse me. So are there any questions about what are called higher order functions before I go on with today's lecture? So today, what we're going to do, oh, sorry about that. I have some kind of bug. It's making my throat very itchy. Today, what we're going to do is we're going to look in detail at one particular technical aspect that affects Haskell and any other programming language you will use called scope. So I think we have an example here. So let's say we have a Haskell program and it says x is 2, y is x plus 1, and z is x plus y times y. And then we load that program and run it in the interpreter, and we type z, and it will, of course, type 11. Now, the only if you typed w, it would say, I don't know what w is, right? So the important thing about the stupid computer is that it needs to know what names have what meaning at what place in the program. And this differs from place to place. So this is the issue of scope. And whenever you define a variable, one of the questions you want to ask is, well, what is the scope of that variable? Of course, the names of the variables don't matter. Oh, well, sorry, we'll talk about that in a minute. So x is bound to 2. This is called the binding occurrence of x. And then y is x plus 1. X is bound. This is why when the stupid computer evaluates y, it says x is a formal and the corresponding actual is 2. The value of x is 2. It's finding the binding occurrence of x. Similarly for this x. So the scope of the binding, the places you're allowed to write x, are any of the bits in blue. Right? We could have written x here. We happen to write z, but x is defined at that point. Similarly for y, now notice that these definitions are recursive. Y is actually allowed to appear in the definition of x, and x does appear in the definition of y. Right? When we get up to functions, you know how recursion is important. So the scope of y is all of these definitions, and the main thing. And the scope of z is also all of these definitions and the interactive input line. And of course, right, the names of the variables don't matter. You can pick any names you like as long as they're consistent. So if we replace x uniformly by Xavier, that's fine. You can replace y by Yolanda and so on. It doesn't have to be a name beginning with the same letter. Okay, so this should be pretty straightforward. Are there any questions about that? Okay, nod your head if you're bored. Right, you know my goal is to make you bored. Okay, so let's make things a little bit trickier and look at functions. So now let's say f of x is g of x and x plus 1. So g is a function of two arguments. And we'll say g of x and y is x plus y times y. And then f of 2, well, x will be 2. So we'll have g of 2 and 2 plus 1, that's 3. So x will be 2, y will be 3, and 2 plus 3 times 3 is 11. So here's the binding occurrence of x. Oh, and look! Its scope isn't everywhere. Where is this x defined? Just on the right-hand side of the corresponding equation, and nowhere else. And notice that this x has actually nothing to do with this x. So here's the other x, and its scope is its corresponding equation. So as it says here, there are two unrelated uses of x. And of course, the scope of y is also just the equation it appears in. So if I wrote y up here, the computer would say, what on earth are you talking about? I don't know no y. What is this y? Why have you written y? Right? It wouldn't want a y there, only there. And notice you couldn't write y here either. The scope of y is just the equation defining the function. Is that suitably boring? Okay, at least some of you are bored. That's good. Any questions about that? Yes? Shouldn't you define g before f? No. I'll show you why. Excellent question. What is the scope of g? The scope of g is all the equations. Just like, right, if we go back here, remember the scope of z was all the equations, including the ones that preceded it. And this is useful if you want to write mutually recursive functions, two functions defined in terms of each other. So very good question, but no, we can write these in any order whatsoever. So we can write g there, but its scope is going to be all the equations, and we could write g down here. And similarly, f, its scope is all the equations. We could have defined g in terms of f and f in terms of g if we were using a suitable recursion. And X is what's called a formal parameter, right? And it corresponds to the actual parameter. Right? So the stupid computer, it says, well, X here is the formal, and it's bound to the actual, which is 2. Which is why when it copies out the body here, the bound occurrences of X are replaced by the actual. And notice here, it just happens to be the case that our formal parameter is X and the corresponding actual is X. This is how the two different X's get linked, because one X is passed as an actual with the other X as a formal. Right, so we happen to pick those to be the same name, but we didn't need to do that. And then, of course, the formal for Y is X plus 1. And then here again, I've renamed things, and notice that the two different X's I've changed to different names. So this time, Xavier is the actual, and Xerox is the formal. So in copying out this body here, every time it sees Xerox, it'll be replaced by the value of Xavier. Similarly, we can do where clauses. So wait, before I go on, I've had several good questions about this. Any other questions? Okay, so now I've got f of x is z, where y is x plus 1, and z is x plus y times y. Again, it's helpful to know the scope. Right, what is the scope of x? Is it just this one line? No, it's this one line plus all the attached where bindings. So I can use x here, and that's fine. So the scope of x is the entire left-hand side of the equation. The scope of y is also the entire left-hand side of the equation, and same for z. So that's why it's okay to define z down here, but use it up here. And then the scope of f, well, we could have defined it recursively, and also f can be used at the top level. Notice that x, y, and z, none of those are in scope here. If I typed x, y, or z here, it wouldn't know what we were talking about. If I also define y here, notice that this y and this y have nothing to do with each other. This y is in scope down here. This y is not. Okay, so we've had functions, we've had where clauses, so we have functions defined in a where clause. And now the interesting thing, notice that the scope of x is the whole body again, so notice that x is defined within this function. That's okay. Right, remember before we had g of x and y? Here we've just said g of y, but it knows what x is because the x is bound in what's called an outer scope. But the scope of y is just the equation in which it appears. The scope of g is the whole right-hand side. So this might seem a little bit confusing. Hopefully it seems fairly natural. But I'll show you in a bit how we can explain all this just using lambda expressions, and all the scoping rules follow from that. So in fact, these are very natural and straightforward scoping rules. Similarly, I could have two definitions here, one of f and one of g, and notice that this g and this g have nothing to do with each other. So now if I say g of 2, it's this g, so z becomes 2, and z times z times z will be 8. Oh, and this is what I call a pathological case. Don't do this. Right? This will just confuse you. Normally, the scope of f is the whole body, but here, I've defined an f within f. So which f does this one mean? Well, it turns out it means the closer definition, which is actually the one on the inside of the function body. So if this makes your head hurt, good. Just never do it. Always make sure that when two scopes overlap, that the variables have different names. Is it not dangerous even allowing that? Excellent question. In fact, I've been involved in language design committees where people spent a long time debating whether this sort of thing should be allowed. And most programming languages do allow it, but I think you might be right, and it might be better to disallow it. The reason why it's allowed is, if you think about it, you actually take advantage of this all the time. You tend to import, right, you always import the Haskell standard prelude. You don't know the names of all the functions in the standard prelude. If it didn't allow this redefinition, you'd have to know the names so you could avoid collision in the bound variables in your functions. But that's an excellent question. Thank you. Okay, and then we've got formals and actuals again. Comprehensions work in a very similar way, right? If we say f of x is x times x for x drawn from x is x greater than 0, then the scope of x's is just the body of the definition. And what's the scope of this x? Right, the scope of this x that's bound here is the entire comprehension. So when I say x times x, it means this x. When I say x greater than 0, it means this x. Here's a pathological case again. F of x, x times x, x drawn from x, where x is greater than 0. Right? This is not an easy program to read. One thing that motivated me to show this is I actually found a student writing this. And they hadn't noticed that they used the same name here and here. And I said, well, you really don't want to do that. But it does actually have a meaning. And notice that since this x rebinds x, the scope of x here is not the whole side, because these x's refer to this one, not to this one. So this is what's called a hole in scope. You've rebound things. And so the question, well, should you allow this, is should you allow holes in scope? And certainly for something simple like this, it'd really be better not to allow it.
Does it work?
Does this work? Oh, yes. Alas, it works. OK, so as before, the bound occurrence of x binds everything else in the term. Note one other thing. Notice here, when we bound x, it's defined in all the later guards and in the head, but not in the whole comprehension, not here. So when you do a drawn from, that cannot be recursive. And then for higher order functions, I think we've seen everything we need to see, so this is now all pretty straightforward. Right? The scope of f is everywhere. The scope of x's is this part of the function definition. The scope of x is just the equation in which it appears. Similarly for this x, so these are two different x's, just like we saw different x's before. They could be given different names. And the scope of square is the whole definition, and the same for positive. And then what about map? Where's the binding occurrence for map? Well, that's off in the standard prelude somewhere. Map is a function that's already defined for you when you start to use Haskell. So in fact, at the beginning of your file, you sometimes write lines like import char or import test.quickcheck. That's referring to other files that you're importing definitions from. So the binding occurrences for some variables will be in those files. So in this case, the binding occurrence of map is in a file called the standard prelude. To be absolutely consistent, you should write import prelude at the beginning of the program. But it'd be a real pain to always have to write import prelude, so it just happens automatically. And the same for filter. Filter is defined in the standard prelude. Okay. So now let's look at our friend, the lambda expression. Right, so let's review. Where do lambda expressions come from? Remember yesterday we saw map square filter positive of x's. And we thought, oh, couldn't we just write that saying x times x and x greater than 0? Well, now you can understand why that's wrong. Right? It's because here we have a bound occurrence of x with no binding occurrence. Right? For every variable that you see, you should ask, where is the binding occurrence? And for that binding occurrence, where is it bound? Here there is no binding occurrence. It's not in the standard prelude. Standard prelude doesn't define x for us. And we want these two things to, in fact, be different x's. So we need binding occurrences for them. You have a question? Thank you. Yes, I fixed the typos in the first part of the talk, but not the second. Oh, no, this isn't a typo. No. F does have type list event to list event. Yesterday we saw F with a sum in it, but here there's no sum. So the way you fix things, right, is you include the binding occurrence. And that's what lambda expressions are. So here we've got the two binding occurrences. As I mentioned yesterday, this backslash actually stands for the Greek letter lambda. And mathematicians, instead of writing backslash x dash greater than x star x, they would just write lambda x dot x times x. So we're a little bit limited being stuck with the keys we can type. I saw a hand up. Was there a question? So now we can see, right, this is the binding occurrence, and here's where it's bound for the first x. And this is the binding occurrence, and here's where it's bound for the second x. Of course, we could use different names for these two things because they're completely distinct variables. So the payoff of all this is that everything that I've shown you can be done just using lambda. So for instance, if I say some big term, n, where x is equal to some other term, m, that's the same as saying lambda x n m. In other words, every single occurrence of binding that you've seen can be explained by writing a lambda expression that binds the important variable. So right, where binds x? We can turn that into a lambda expression, right? If you think about this as, well, this is a function. X is bound within the body of that function. So the scope of X is n. And what value does X have? X is a formal variable whose corresponding actual is m. So we do that as a function application. So the binding that we did here could be rewritten as a function application. And notice when you're defining a function, of course, that can be done with lambda expressions as well. Instead of saying f of x is equal to n, we could have said f is the function lambda x dot n. So let's see an example of how that works. Question? Could you use parentheses to limit scope? Well, when you write a lambda expression...
But can you use it on blocks of code? Like, close down...
Blocks of code?
Yeah.
What's a block of code?
Well, I've got 15 functions. Mm-hmm. And I want, for example, 3 of them to be out of scope for the rest.
Right. So if you have 15 functions and you want 3 of them to only be in scope in a certain place, that's where you would use a where with those 3 functions defined in the where. Right? Where is precisely for limiting scope in that way. But then the body of the where must be a single expression.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see an example. F of 2, where f of x is x plus y times y, where y is x plus 1. Okay, well, let's look first at this body. So we said f of x is equal to this thing, but that's the same saying f is lambda x, and then here's the body, x plus y times y, where y equals x plus 1. I've written it on one line instead of three lines, but it's the same thing. Now, x plus y times y, where y is x plus 1, this says y is bound to x plus 1, so to do that I can say lambda y, x plus y times y, applied to x plus 1. So when we do the application, y will get bound to x plus 1, which is what we want. And then finally, I've got f of 2 where f is equal to this. I've got, again, a where. So I can say lambda f of 2 applied to this term here. I just need to write parentheses around it.
This seems a bit confusing.
It's much easier to read this than to read this, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. But the reason I'm showing it to you is because all the scope rules I've showed you are consistent with this definition. And it also shows that you can define a very powerful language, you can reduce it to just a very tiny number of constructs. Pretty much everything in Haskell, the Haskell compiler itself, right, there are lots of different ways of writing things in Haskell, where and if and case, and function definitions, and variable definitions, and where definitions that define functions, and so on. All of those are translated out in this way. The actual compiler only knows about 8 things, and that's it. So what I'm showing you here is how the uniformity works. And then if we want to actually evaluate the lambda expression, right, we can just do what we've done before, which is always replace the argument in the lambda expression, the formal, by the actual. So f here stands for this. We just copy out this with f replaced by that. So it's this whole thing applied to 2. Now we've got lambda x thingy applied to 2. So we just replace x by 2 within thingy, and we'll get that. Now we've got lambda y, 2 plus y times y applied to 2 plus 1. 2 plus 1 is 3. Now we have an actual 3 we can substitute for the formal y. So we copy this out with y replaced by 3. We get 2 plus 3 times 3. And there we go. We've got 11. So the easy way is to look at that and say, oh, that's 11, which is fine if you can do it. But the actual way the computer does it, if you want to understand, is it painstakingly translates all this into lambda expressions, and then it painstakingly goes through and evaluates those. Yes?
Does this mean that if you write lambda expressions, it would be easier for the
Does this mean that you should write lambda expressions to make life easy for the computer? No. Your job is not to make life easy for the computer. The computer's job is to make life easy for you. So it's perfectly fine, and I would encourage you to write what is readable, and then let the computer do the translation into something that's unreadable but easy for the computer to use. The computer can expand this to this in a fraction of a second, a very tiny fraction of a second. If it's a really, really big program, really, really, really big, it might take it 2 tiny fractions of a second. It would take it a lot less time than it would take you. Your job is to make the program readable. The computer's job is to execute the program. Good question. Okay, and then we can go through all this and work out what are the scope of all these things, right? This is the binding occurrence of x, there's where it's bound. This is the binding occurrence of x, there's where it's bound, and so on. And you'll notice that that these all correspond to what I showed you before about scopes of variables. Okay, so that's why I wanted to show you about binding. We have a little bit of time left, so now I'm going to go on and show you a little bit about list comprehensions and how the binding works in those, and a bit about, again, how we define the meaning of list comprehensions in terms of simpler constructs. Right, so up to now, I've given you lots and lots of different constructs, right? List comprehensions and wheres and function definitions and variable definitions. So for most of these things, you've now seen how those all translate into just one thing, which is lambda. And now we'll do the same thing with list comprehensions. So it might have seemed like you had to learn lots of different things. And it might seem like, well, do I always know exactly what this means? Do I always know exactly what the scope of a variable would be? Learning how to understand the meaning of something by translating it into something simpler, like lambda, is a very good way of being sure that you understand precisely what's going on. So many people go through life perfectly productive as programmers without having this deeper understanding. But I think this deeper understanding is a useful thing to have. And in particular, things like list comprehensions are so wonderful, they can almost seem like magic. Right? The computer just knows what I want and does it. No, it doesn't. It has very simple rules it's applying to translate this thing into lambda expressions, and that knows exactly what the lambda expressions mean. So there's no magic there at all, only stupidity. Stupidity beats magic every time.
Can you use lambda expressions to prove, for formal proof, what program is doing or if it's doing what we expect?
Right, so the question is about how do we do formal proof. That will, in fact, be the subject of the lecture Phil Scott's going to give next Tuesday. And since lambda expressions are very helpful in giving a precise meaning to programs, you're quite right in believing that they can have a nice role in doing proofs. And in fact, most of the, there are lots and lots of systems out there where a computer will help you come up with a proof of things, and they're all based around lambda expressions. This is why it is the logician Alonzo Church who invented the lambda expression. He was trying to make logic very simple and uniform. He wasn't trying to do computers, because computers hadn't been invented yet. Right? This is how we know lambda expressions are a good thing, right? They were invented 10 years before the first stored program computer. Okay, so here's list comprehensions with two qualifiers. You've seen this in the book, but I don't think we've done one of these in a lecture yet. So f of n is the list of ij pairs for I drawn from 1 to n and for j drawn from I to n. So this means all possible pairs where a is a number between 1 and n and j is a number between I and n. So that would mean j could be 1, sorry, I could be 1, 2, or 3. And when I is 1, j could be anything between 1 and 3. But when it's 2, j can be only 2 or 3. And when I is 3, the only possibility for j is 3. So let's look at the occurrences, right? F is defined everywhere, as you'd expect. Whoops. I is defined in the head and in all following qualifiers. Right? That's why we can use I here. I is in scope. J isn't defined here. It's only defined in following qualifiers, and there aren't any. So J is defined in the head, but nowhere else. Now let's see how to evaluate this. Right? You know the rules. Let's get stupid. IJ. I drawn from 1 to 3, J drawn from 1 to 3. Okay, that means I copy out the whole comprehension 3 times. Once with I replaced by 1, once with I replaced by 2, and once with I replaced by 3. So the first time I get 1 J, J drawn from I to 3, that's 1 to 3. The next time I've got IJ, that's 2J, for J drawn from I to 3, that's 2 to 3. And the next time I is 3, and I get IJ, that's 3J for J drawn from I to 3. That's 3 to 3. And I append them all together. Okay? So this one comprehension turns into three smaller comprehensions that get appended together. Okay? And then IJ, sorry, 1J for J drawn from 1 to 3, what do? We're going to copy this out three times. Once with J replaced by 1, once with J replaced by 2, once with J replaced by 3. So we get one, well, actually it would be the list 1, 1, the list 1, 2, and the list 1, 3 all appended together, which then gives us this list. Similarly, this evaluates to that, and this evaluates to that. So the whole thing gives us the expected list. So this is quite a useful technique, being able to use two comprehensions, sorry, two generators in a comprehension. Is this clear enough to people? Nod your head if that's clear. Good, lots of head nodding. Anybody want to ask a question? You didn't nod your head. Yes, I'm looking at you. You did understand. Okay, so here's another example, very similar. IJ, I drawn from 1 to 3, J drawn from 1 to 3, where I is less than or equal to J. So you can see, oh, this ought to do the same as the previous one. How does it do it? So notice first, let's look at the scope. What's the scope of this J here? It's not defined here, but it is defined here, and it's also defined in the following qualifier. So again, we just copy this out three times, with I replaced by 1, 2, and 3 each time. So we get three comprehensions. And then we copy, now J goes from 1 to 3, so each of these gets copied out three times. And of course, the qualifier gets copied through. Right? So the first time we copied it out, I was replaced by 1, 2, and 3 each place. Now J gets replaced by 1, 2, and 3 three times. So each of these, right, is telling us, is 1 less than or equal to 1? Yes. Is 1 less than or equal to 2? Yes. Is 1 less than or equal to 3? Yes. Is 2 less than or equal to 1? No. Is 2 less than or equal to 2? Yes. Is 2 less than or equal to 3? Yes. Is 3 less than or equal to 1? No. Is 3 less than or equal to 2? No. Is 3 less than or equal to 3? Uh-huh. So the three places where it was no vanish, all the others one stay, and when you concatenate it together, you get that. Does everybody see why that comprehension gives that answer? So no magic to it. There's some very straightforward rules to apply. So I said we want to do things without magic. What does this look like? Okay, so we need two definitions. I've left one out, of course. Right, we need the definition of map. We need the definition of concat from before. Does everybody remember that? Concat takes a list of lists and appends it together. And we need the, and then concat map will just be concat applied to mapping F. So notice that in map, F is any function from A to B, and it takes a list of A and returns a list of B. In concat map, right, concat takes a list of lists to a list. So our function is going to take a value A and return a list of B. And then our function will take a list of A. We map F over that list of A. We convert each A to a list of B. So our list of A becomes a list of B, which we concatenate together to get a list of B. We'll see how that works in a minute. So here are the translation rules. Expression E for X drawn from L, that just becomes map lambda XE over L. Does that do the right thing? Well, what we're supposed to do is replace X within E once by each possible value in L. Of course, that's exactly what map lambda XE L will do. If we write E vertical bar B, which seems weird, right? But we did it just here. Right? And this does work in Haskell. So expressions such that guard, the list of all expressions such that guard. So we either just returns a list containing one thing or the empty list. So that's defined as just if B is true, then return the list containing E. Otherwise, return the empty list. That's exactly what we were using. And then in general, of course, it's E X drawn from L, and then another qualifier Q, and E guard B, and another qualifier Q. And so now instead of a map, we'll use the body of this thing. Now it's not an expression E. It's it's another comprehension, E such that Q. So again, we want to evaluate this once for each thing in L. So we map lambda x, the comprehension E such that Q, over L. And then we concatenate together all the comprehensions we got. Right? That's exactly what we did here. So what this would change into is lambda I, the comprehension ij such that, such that j is drawn from 1 to 3, and I is less than or equal to j. So in the particular case we're looking at, E would be the pair ij, X would be I, L would be the list of numbers from 1 to 3, Q would be these two qualifiers, j drawn from 1 to 3, and I less than or equal to j. So that's why this works. And then E for B such that Q just becomes if B, then E drawn from Q, else empty. Now you can see why when we do X drawn from L, what the scope of X is. Clearly, right, we've written lambda X, open bracket E bar Q, right? The scope of X is this. So X is in scope in E and in scope in Q, but not in scope within L. So that's why when we looked at the scopes and we did I drawn from 1 to N, I is in scope in E, in scope in Q, but not in scope in L. So now you can see where those scoping rules come from. No magic, very simple translation rules. So here's some simple examples. So x times x, x drawn from x's, just becomes map lambda x, x times x over x's. So within Haskell, the meaning of this is actually this. X times x, x drawn from x is x greater than 0. Now we do a concat map of lambda x, x times x, x greater than 0, and over x's. And then this bit then becomes if x is greater than 0, then the list x times x, otherwise the empty list. And then if you evaluated this, you would see it evaluates just the same way this does. If you've got ij, I drawn from 1 to n, j drawn from 1 to n, so that would become a concat map of I with the list of all pairs ij for j drawn from 1 to n. And this 1 to n gets copied to here. This I to n gets copied to here. And then this comprehension itself turns into a map of lambda j, ij pairs for I drawn from 1 to n. And again, if you evaluate this, you'll see it behaves just like what we had before. And then here's an even more complicated, here's the last example we looked at, ij, I from 1 to n, j from 1 to n, I less than j. So q, right, we've got e bar x drawn from L, and then q is both of these. So it becomes a concat map, lambda I, here's e, here's q, here's L. And then this comprehension turns into a concat map with a comprehension inside it. And that comprehension turns into an if-then-else. And again, if you evaluated this out, you would see that the evaluation of this term here will look almost exactly like the evaluation that we wrote out here. We've just right, so between here and here, there'd be some maps and so on, but it will look very, very similar. Any questions about that?
Could we see the most basic definition of the lambda sine or calculus?
What is the most basic definition of the lambda calculus?
Yeah.
Right. You can write out the whole thing. A lambda expression is one of three things. It's a variable. Sorry, an expression of lambda calculus is a variable. It's lambda x dot some expression, the body, or it's one expression applied to another expression. And there's only one rule that tells you how to evaluate lambda expressions. It says if you've got lambda x E1 applied to E2, you can replace this by, this is equal to, we always write equal signs when we're playing stupid computer, the body E1 with the all occurrences of the formal X replaced by the actual E2. So good question. That's it. This is all you need to know to define lambda expressions. Three forms of expression, one rule for evaluation. That's it, the complete definition. The Java programming language has a definition that's a book yay thick. That's the complete definition of the lambda calculus. Which would you rather be examined on? So, any other questions? And the actual definition of Haskell, as I said, is not quite that simple. We need a few other constructs. But instead of three things, there are a total of eight, and there are not many more rules. So the actual Haskell compiler is based on using formalisms similar to this one. By the way, right, remember our theme of arithmetic? Have you noticed where the arithmetic is here? If you append a list of length m to a list of length n, what is the length of the result? All together now? M plus n. If you do a comprehension over two lists, say this list has length m and this list has length n, and say it does not involve this variable, so that it always has length n, right? The length of this list in this case varies. But let's say this list has length m, and this list always has length n, what would the length of the result be? M times n. So append is addition, that's why we write it plus plus, and a comprehension with two generators is very similar to multiplication. For those of you that know Cartesian product from set theory, that would actually be the set of all xy pairs, x drawn from the first set, y drawn from the second set. So this, among other things, gives us the power of Cartesian product. So in summary, what have we learned about today? We've learned about the scope of bound variables, which is a tricky thing, but worth knowing about. We've learned about list comprehensions with more than one generator, which are very powerful and very useful. We've learned for every single construct we've ever seen in Haskell how to expand it out into simple definitions involving lambda expressions. So that there's no magic there, everything translates out to something very simple. We've seen a very simple definition of a language. So we've seen that you can get very powerful languages from very simple definitions. If you've only seen things like C or Java, you might not have realized that that's the case. And finally, of course, in conclusion, I hope you've really learned to appreciate that when you've got a tough job, that's a job for lambda calculus. Thank you very much. Okay, good luck. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
after the last exam or something like that?
Yes. Yes, could you send an email to the TAs asking them about that? Because I won't be around. But it's a fair point. If you ask them directly, they can do something about it.
Yeah, because I've done all the